right off the bat, but of course it was not. Apparently, Sonic's incredible aerodynamics had backfired, and a vicious gust of wind had rammed him right into a lamppost at West 58th Street and Broadway. Because of the balloon's size and velocity, a light fixture had fallen and hit an off-duty Suffolk County police captain named Joseph D. Kistinger. The medics on hand believed that he had broken his shoulder and were about to rush him to the hospital.
"Is this a joke?"
Kalinske asked incredulously, glancing at his daughter stationed by the window.
"No, I'm sorry," Lynch said. "It's just windy, that's all. Bad luck for us."
Maybe it really was just bad luck. Something to laugh about a few years down the line. But in the moment it felt like something more than that. Fate? Karma? Metaphorical proof of a company in decline? To the outside world, decline would have been the last word to describe Sega. After the release of Mortal Kombat, Sega had pulled past Nintendo and was hotter than ever. Kalinske, of course, was thrilled by this. But ever since SOJ had thwarted the potential deals with Sony and SGI, he'd started to notice cracks in the foundation. Little things, usually, but things that he hadn't paid much attention to before. For example, Ryo had been pushing harder than ever for permission to manufacture hardware in North America. It would be cheaper this way, and save time on shipping, but SOJ would not allow it. They manufactured all of the hardware, that's just how it was. At this point, however, the cultural differences with SOJ were to be expected, but it was an unexpected incident that had him most concerned. In early 1993, Sega had made the decision to split up Sonic 3 into two separate games. This was a calculated risk, one that they likely would have taken again, but between that decision and now, one of the game's best assets had been eliminated. Michael Jackson. While the company was working on the soundtrack for Sonic 3, allegations surfaced that Jackson had molested a 13-year-old boy. True or not, the stigma was too crippling to ignore. So a decision was made to unwind the deal with Jackson and remove any association he had with the game. At the time, that too seemed to be just a case of bad luck. But between that, the Senate calling subcommittee hearings and the Sonic balloon fiasco, bad luck seemed to be an unfortunate trend.
"What would you like me to do?" Lynch asked.
The only good part about receiving this lousy news from Brenda Lynch was that, well, he was receiving it from Brenda Lynch, and when it came to spinning stories, that woman was a black widow. "Get down to the hospital," Kalinske instructed, "and try to make this significantly less bad."
"I'll do you one better," Lynch replied. "How about making this into something good?"
Before Kalinske could answer, she was already gone. Lynch ran through the snow-paced streets of New York City, leaving behind her husband and two children, so that she could get to the hospital and twist bad luck into something good. In the following days, the press broadcast all sorts of stories about Sega's balloon going rogue, but instead of focusing on an officer down, they were almost all about how Sonic was simply too damn fast to ever slow down. Chapter 56. Combat Pay. Bill White hadn't necessarily planned to pull out the gun, but when he noticed the way everyone in the room was looking at him, he felt like he had no choice. The chips had been stacked against him from the beginning, ever since Senator Herbert Cole, Democrat, Wisconsin, called the session to order. "This meeting," he had begun stoically, "is a joint meeting between Senator Lieberman's Governmental Affairs Subcommittee of Government Regulation and Information and my Judiciary Subcommittee on Juvenile Justice." That first sentence had sounded harmless, like run-of-the-mill politico speak. But after that, it became open season. "Before I turn the meeting over to Senator Lieberman, I want to make one point. Today is the first day of Hanukkah, and we have already begun the Christmas season. It is a time when we think about peace on earth and goodwill towards all people, and also about giving gifts to our friends and our loved ones. But it is also a time when we need to take a close, hard look at just what it is that we are actually buying for our kids. That is why we are holding this hearing on violent video games at this time. That is why we intend to introduce legislation on violent video games as soon as Congress returns. Senator Lieberman?"
"Thank you very much, Senator Cole," Lieberman had said, and then got right down to it. "Every day the news brings more and more images of violence, torture, and sexual aggression. Violence and violent images permeate more and more aspects of our lives, and I think it's time to draw the line. I know that one place parents want us to draw the line is with violence and video games. And then he said it. The soundbite that would forever define these hearings. Like the Grinch who stole Christmas, these violent video games threaten to rob this particular holiday season of a spirit of goodwill. After the good senators had set the tone for the hearings, a parade of assorted experts delivered testimony before the representatives from Sega and Nintendo, who were brought in to defend their livelihood. Parker Page, president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center, spoke first. He suggested that the federal government fund an independent research into the psychological effects of video games, as not enough was known at the time, and he recommended that until more was known, the industry ought to put a cap on the amount of violence allowed. After that, the floor went to Eugene Provenzo, a sociology professor at the University of Miami, who had recently published a book on the subject, Video Kids, Making Sense of Nintendo. He indicated that his extensive research had revealed that beneath the fun of a seemingly harmless diversion lurked a number of insidious themes. During the past decade, the video game industry has developed games whose social content has been overwhelmingly violent, sexist, and racist. Following Provenzo came Robert Chase, vice president of the National Education Association. He began by warning against the dangers of censorship, but then seemed to upend his own thesis by explaining the incalculable negative effects of this new form of entertainment. Electronic games, because they are active rather than passive, can do more than desensitize impressionable children to violence. They actually encourage violence as the resolution of first resort by rewarding participants for killing one's opponents in the most grisly ways imaginable. The last of the experts was Marilyn Dross, vice president of the National Coalition on Television Violence, who simultaneously complained about too much video game violence and not enough video games for girls. After these experts had delivered their diverse pleas for caution, a group of industry representatives were invited to take a seat in front of the senators. This panel of five included Don Wiener, Video Software Dealers Association, Craig Johnson, Amusement and Music Operations Association, Eileen Rosenthal, Software Publishers Association, and the main attractions, Howard Lincoln, Nintendo, and Bill White, Sega, who were seated beside each other, only adding to the tension. Howard Lincoln spoke first, and from the moment he opened his mouth, it was clear that there was no environment on Earth that could ever make him appear unpoised. The man had nerves of steel through and through, which appeared even more impressive in contrast to White's natural reticence. In the past year, some very violent and offensive games have reached the market, Lincoln described. And of course I am speaking about Mortal Kombat and Night Trap. He spoke briskly but calmly about the conscious business decision that Nintendo made back in 1985 not to allow violence or pornography, eschewing profits in favor of ensuring quality content. This was the Nintendo way, a relentless commitment to values, and as proof that it hadn't wavered since, he cited the company's decision to censor Mortal Kombat. And not only had the company left money on the table by making this decision, they'd also received thousands of angry calls and letters from parents around the country who criticized Nintendo for censorship. If Senator Lieberman hadn't already seemed to favor Nintendo, then Lincoln's comment about the blowback clinched it. Which made it even tougher when the man from Sega spoke next. White did everything possible to defend Sega's actions. The average Sega user is almost 19 years old, and appealed to those in the room as both a father of two boys, age 5 and 8, and a former Nintendo employee, having worked there for 5 years. But no matter what he said, it appeared the die had already been cast. He was the villain, and his attempts to appear anything less than evil made his villainy all the more obvious. The longer this went on, the worse things got for White. Some of this was due to Lincoln's well-crafted expressions of exasperation. I can't sit here and allow you to be told that somehow the video game business has transformed today from children to adults. It hasn't been. And Mr. White, who is a former Nintendo employee, knows the demographics as well as I do. Some of it was due to Senator Lieberman's continual praise of Nintendo, which he felt had been a damn sight better than the competition.
And some of it was due to the way that clips from some of Sega's latest commercials seemed to offend just about everyone in the room. And as the hearings transformed into a well-dressed, well-worded pylon session, White saw no other option to defend his and Sega's honor, so he took it out. The gun. He held it up proudly, like a championship belt, Nintendo's big gray Super Scope bazooka. White had brought it with him to Washington without advising anyone from Sega, and kept it under the desk in case things got out of hand. As the eyes in the room squinted at him with disdain, he saw no other option, and so he pulled it out. "A rapid-fire machine gun," White said decisively. "And they have no rating on that product." It should have been Bill White's moment of triumph, delivering the kind of personal screw-you that creates a lifelong pocket of confidence, but he had flubbed his words. Upon lifting up the bazooka, White had said accusingly, "I may also point out that Sega produces this product," when obviously he had meant to fire a kill shot at Nintendo by naming it as the producer. Was this actually an illuminating Freudian slip, indicating that the only executive who had worked at both Sega and Nintendo saw, deep down, that the two companies were interchangeable? Perhaps. But it didn't matter. Bill White had fired a silver bullet, and as noble as the effort had been, nobody in the room appeared to be particularly moved by it, causing the shot to come right back at him.
"No!"
Kalinske exclaimed when he heard White jumble his words. He was back in Redwood Shores watching it live on C-SPAN from the television in his office, and despite the flub, he was very pleased with how White had handled himself. Perpetually poised, meticulously defensive, and just the right amount of angry. And so the following day, when White returned and walked through the office doors at Sega of America, he was greeted by a standing ovation. Peter Main's former protege had delivered an admirable performance for Sega, and as a result, Senator Lieberman and the other members of the committee had decided to give the industry a chance to regulate themselves before the government chose to intervene. There would be additional hearings in March 1994 to check in and see if enough progress had been made, but for now, the threat had been deterred. For Kalinske, this turn of events meant even more than just Sega's safety, and it relieved the lump on his conscience that had been growing for some time. Whether he was the true villain for having allowed such games to be released or the actual hero for creating the first rating system didn't matter anymore. It was time to move forward, and he would be doing so unscathed. He had Bill White to thank for that. To show his gratitude, Kalinske gave White the largest Christmas bonus that he had ever received. When he asked his boss what it was for, Kalinske smiled and explained that it hadn't been his idea. "As you know, a week or two after your triumphant performance, I went down to Capitol Hill to speak with many of the same men who had grilled you. One of them, of course, was Senator Lieberman. I asked him what he thought about how you handled yourself, and you know what he said?"
"B+.
Kalinske laughed.
"He said, for what he put up with, that kid deserves combat pay."
He motioned with his chin to the bonus check.
"Well, as an upstanding American, I've been taught that it's wise to listen to your government representatives. So, there you go."
Chapter 57. Life on Mars. Tom Kalinske, Paul Ryo, Shinobu Toyoda, and Joe Miller were all in Vegas for the 1994 Winter CES, and they could all be found slowly walking down one of the exquisite hallways in the Alexis Park Hotel as they approached Nakayama's suite.
"Do you think he watched the hearings?" Miller asked.
"Watched them?" Kalinske asked. "Or will admit to watching them?"
"I know that he saw at least a part," Toyoda put in, anticlimactically ending the group's speculation about Sega of Japan's volatile ruler.
When they arrived at his suite, they were ushered in to sit down with Nakayama-san and his chief lieutenants at SOJ to discuss the future. In the hours that followed, a lot of strategies for the year ahead were tossed around, but amongst SOJ's diversity of strategies, one thing was clear. They were ready to kill the Genesis.
"Look," Kalinske said, "I think that staying on the cutting edge is as important as everyone else in the room, but not at the expense of something that's still working. I mean, we're barely even in the middle of the console's life cycle."
This statement was generally accurate, but it was also false, which is what accounted for part of the schism in the room. Kalinske considered the summer of 1991 to be the de facto American launch of the Genesis,
That was when SOA had dropped the price, introduced Sonic, and started doing the kind of marketing that would redefine Sega. If that was considered the starting point of the life cycle, then this was really only year three. Sega of Japan, on the other hand, had released the Mega Drive in August 1988, never enjoyed the second win that SOA had, and consequently viewed this as something like year six. Ultimately, though, this all boiled down to the fact that despite SOA's earth-shattering success with the Genesis, SOJ had continued to strike out with their Mega Drive. As a result, Nakayama proposed moving forward with a pair of systems to take Sega into the next generation. Project Saturn, a CD-based system with 32-bit technology that would effectively serve as Sega's next-generation console. No surprise here. This was the SOJ-only system that had been selected in favor of developing something with Sony and Silicon Graphics. Project Mars, a cartridge-based system with 32-bit-like capabilities. This was basically a souped-up version of the Genesis. Kalinske understood the merits of the Saturn, which would eventually replace the Genesis as Sega's next-generation console. But what exactly was Mars supposed to be? SOJ had been pitching this 32-bit-like device for almost a year now. He had been shown something very similar to this back when he'd first seen the Pico. But as much as he enjoyed pushing the envelope with new products, he wasn't convinced that Sega would have the resources to fully support this. Nor were Ryo, Toyota, and Miller, as well as Nilsson, who was adamantly against this until the day he left. Sega was already asking developers to create games for the Genesis, the Game Gear, the Sega CD, and the upcoming Pico. That already pushed the limit, and that's why the guys from SOA couldn't help but look at one another, spooked by the idea of adding more hardware to the mix. To clarify the supposed necessity, Nakayama explained that Mars would bridge the gap between the Genesis and the Saturn. Kalinske didn't understand what gap needed to be bridged. The Genesis was still selling well, and the Saturn would be out in just over a year. But Nakayama explained that this wasn't an issue up for debate. It was now starting to become clear that Kalinske was no longer the chief decision-maker. Sega of Japan was sick of being compared to the much more successful SOA, and sick of watching the company's name get dragged through the mud in Washington. So they had decided that it was time to take back the company, at whatever cost. So Kalinske had better buck up and get used to life on Mars. Frustrating as the meeting in Nakayama's suite may have been, it wasn't the only get-together between those with opposing ideas for the future. In an effort to prevent Washington from putting the video game industry at the whims of the FCC, representatives from Sega, Nintendo, and the prominent players in the software industry agreed to a secret off-site meeting in Vegas. The cloak-and-dagger aspects may have felt a bit excessive, but they were necessary to avoid allegations of market collusion. The first few hours consisted of little more than shouting and swearing. "This is all your fault. No, it's all yours. Fuck you. No, fuck you." But beneath the infighting, the meeting provided an interesting opportunity for the folks from Sega and Nintendo to finally sit down in the same room. Tom Kalinske, Shinobu Toyota and Bill White, Howard Lincoln, Peter Main and George Harrison. All the alpha dogs had willingly come to the trough. "We've all come here for a common goal," Kalinske explained, "and the answer seems rather simple. Why doesn't everyone simply adopt Sega's rating system?" "How is that the simple solution?" Peter Main asked. "Why adopt a system at all?" Lincoln asked. "Nintendo already closely reviews all of its content." "How many times do you plan to repeat that?" White wondered aloud, and the shouting and swearing escalated once again. In the middle of the bickering, Arthur Pober arrived to discuss the possibility of using his expertise to create an industry-wide rating system, something very similar to what he had created for Sega, but which would address the concerns of the other companies at the table. Shortly after surveying what was going on in the meeting, however, Pober was ready to call it a day. "I have no interest in this," he declared as he walked toward the exit. "You are all men. Act like it." Bill White chased after him, urging him to reconsider, but Pober was adamant and said to call him at the hotel if they ever managed to get their houses in order. Later in the day, while watching some terrible movie that must only ever get watched from hotel rooms, Arthur Pober received a call. Everyone was now on their best behavior, and they would like for him to return. He accepted, put on his jacket, and looked at the clock. It had only taken a few hours. Not awful. Perhaps there was hope for them yet. Pober's optimism was confirmed when he got back to the meeting site. The guys from Sega and Nintendo no doubt despised one another, But beneath the anger and irritation, they were all incredibly smart men. And they were smart enough to know that the he-said-she-said crap gets old real fast. "Look," Kalinske said, "it's obvious our companies have different approaches to doing business. But while we're stuck together in this room, we need to suspend the past."
"Tom's right," Lincoln said in support. "We're all in this thing together, and we need to come out of this with a unified front. I don't like it any more than all of you folks do, but I like it a hell of a lot more than the alternative."
It became clear to Pober rather quickly that in a room full of leaders, Kalinske and Lincoln were the ones whose voices carried weight. And that was a good thing, because he'd worked with them before and knew them both to be capable of one of the rarest defeats, not letting personal feelings or selfish desires cloud their judgment. And so by the end of the day, while nobody would be fool enough to say that Sega and Nintendo, or Kalinske and Lincoln, had become friends, they'd certainly become friendlier than they'd been before, and demonstrated that they were willing to put down their swords in order to fight for the greater good.
"What do you think?" Kalinske asked Joe Miller, who had come into his office not long after CES to check out the latest prototype of the Mars Project.
"I think what you think," Miller said, just with some more technical language.
"Can it be salvaged?"
"Anything can be salvaged, but the question is, at what cost? Regardless, I've been speaking with a couple of the guys at SOJ, and if this is a road they are intent on going down, I have to seriously suggest that we consider doing this as an add-on."
Kalinske shrugged. "Pitch it as the next Sega CD?"
Miller nodded. "Yes, except I would note that the movie-like quality of those titles and the unique look of a compact disc make it an easier pitch."
"Yeah, well," Kalinske said, "if we've got to cut off either our hands or just our thumbs, the thumbs seem like the better choice."
Kalinske relayed this feedback to Nakayama, who is now preoccupied with Project Saturn, which had run into a lot of developmental issues. SOJ needed all hands on deck to fix the Saturn and decided that Miller and his SOA crew should finish up the Mars themselves. As a compromise, they let him do it as an add-on. It was now Sega of America's problem to salvage a product they didn't even want to exist in the first place. Some merely saw this as a hiccup in Sega's plan for world domination. After all, on the surface, Sega still had a bigger market share than Nintendo. But there were others internally who could see that the tsunami was headed their way, and it was time to get out. Two of those men were Richard Burns and Doug Glenn, who had decided that it was time to ride off into the sunset and into another opportunity. Both losses hurt Kalinske, as did remembering that Glenn had a reputation for leaving companies that had reached their tipping point in order to join the next big thing.
"What's that? What you working on? Mind if I take a look?"
Harmon had recently grown accustomed to the constant interruption of questions like these from his colleagues, but it was starting to become a distraction. He knew there was nothing but good intentions behind these inquiries, and he wouldn't have expected any less from Nintendo's congenial open-door atmosphere. But as Rare got closer and closer to finishing the game that he hoped would finally crush Sega, staying focused was more important than ever. That's why he decided he had to speak with Arakawa.
"I see," Arakawa said, weighing the situation. "What shall be done?"
The most obvious solution would have been for Harmon to work out of Rare's office in Leicestershire until the game was complete. But that also would have defeated the purpose of building up NOA's product development capabilities. So in the spirit of his objective, he offered an alternative solution.
"With your permission," Harmon explained, "I would like to build a sealed-off area dedicated solely to development."
"Okay," Arakawa replied, surprising Harmon.
"You don't need me to provide additional explanation?"
Arakawa shook his head. The decision was made.
"I just want to make sure you fully understand what I'm asking for," Harmon said. "Basically, it would be the equivalent of a top-secret, game-centric fort somewhere in the middle of our office."
"Yes," Arakawa said. "This is a good idea."
Harmon smiled serenely, fantasizing about what exactly his treehouse for adults should look like. When Glenn, Burns, and other members of the team left, Kalinske did the same thing as always, smile, nod, and wish them the best of luck, never revealing the icebergs of discontent below that winning smile. That's what he did during the good days,
like the Hedgehog Day event that Fernassier arranged to take in Puxatawney on Groundhog Day 1994. And that's what he did during the bad days, like when he saw specs for Sony's upcoming PSX console. It was rare that anyone could get far enough under Kalinske's skin to unleash the full spectrum of emotions, but Peter Main had made a career out of accomplishing rare feats. And in February 1994, there was something about the way that Main painted Kalinske as a charlatan that got so far under the president of Sega's skin that it sawed deep down into his bones. They were at Piper Jaffray's annual industry conference in New York, where a couple hundred bankers and retailers gathered each year to hear about the profits and potential of the video game industry. Speeches would be made by a variety of analysts, representatives from premier software companies like Acclaim and Electronic Arts, and of course Peter Main and Tom Kalinske. Just like at the CES shows, it was always a war of words between the two. But this conference each February, along with the Gerard Clower Madison one each October, offered an unusual chance for both men to engage in that war from the same room. It was especially exciting for those in attendance to watch as they slung arrows, argued over numbers, and couldn't stop glaring at each other. Normally, Kalinske enjoyed playing up the rivalry and reacting to Main as if they were mortal enemies. But this year, because of everything going on inside Sega, playing a game of heroes and villains just didn't seem as appealing. He was sick of the charade year after year, and wanted Nintendo to just go away. Hadn't he done enough to vanquish them by now? Or at least relieve them of some of their arrogance before Sega went into decline? Despite the fact that since the release of Mortal Kombat, Sega had become the leader in 16-bit, Peter Main still talked about Kalinske as if he were some rube from the toy industry. "Now, after I'm done speaking," Main said, "I'm sure my competitor will try to fatten you up with all sorts of numbers. But I'd like you to ask yourself what these numbers really mean, and where he came up with some of these magical statistics. Oh, and while you're at it, find out if he has any idea what the difference is between sell-in and sell-through." After the snickers of laughter and a few never-short anecdotes from Main, Kalinske finally got his chance to speak. His words carried none of that for-the-greater-good attitude that they had held at the off-site meeting in Vegas. "Is it just me, or does anyone else feel like calling up Dr. Kevorkian whenever Peter Main is done speaking?" And from there, Kalinske didn't relent. "Did you ever notice how Peter Main or any of those guys at Nintendo never has the guts to say my name, or even the word Sega? It's always our competitor, or another company in the industry. But I suppose we should take this as a compliment. After all, it's the same way my daughters refer to the boogeyman and other things that scare them." Although Main, like Kalinske, had a talent for removing personal feelings from judgment, he did not share Kalinske's skill at removing them from his face. He looked angry, as well he should be. Because just as with that dog drinking from the toilet commercial, Kalinske wanted to turn everything into a popularity contest. "But we shouldn't be surprised," Kalinske continued. "I'd be scared too if I were them. Peter wants to talk about numbers, so let me pass along some figures that I notice he forgot to mention. In November, the Nintendo company announced a drop in earnings for the first time in 10 years. As murmurs rippled throughout the audience, Kalinske's eyes glanced at the window, and he noticed that the snow was still coming down hard. There was a storm passing through the city, and they were expecting a few inches or more. But as the relentless whiteness kept falling, he couldn't help reflecting that there was a certain beauty to it. Of course, it wouldn't make finding a cab any easier, but to a guest from California, the snow came as a nice surprise. "Anyway," Kalinske continued, "as I was saying, the numbers look pretty grim. Peter also forgot to mention that Nintendo's first half pre-tax profits dropped 24% from the same time last year. Meanwhile, for those in the audience who like to compare and contrast, Sega's half-year pre-tax profits are up by 4.3%. Kalinske went on to describe the many reasons he believed the two companies were going in opposite directions, and did so with that poke-the-bear flair throughout. "Now, I realize that there are some of you listening," he continued, looking to convert any lingering doubters in the crowd, "who might not believe a word that I've just said. Forget the marketing, you might say. Forget my management style, the work of my team, and Sega's commitment to remaining on the cutting edge. That's not the reason that we have surpassed Nintendo, you might think. It's all just because we were first to market way back when. Obviously, I don't agree with that analysis, but even if that's how you feel, I've got news for you. It's going to happen like that once again." It was true.
Nintendo had made a grave mistake by letting Sega beat them to the 16-bit market, and they had conceded over the past few months that Sega was going to speed past them once again. Nintendo assured the press that everything was going extremely well with Project Reality, and that the new hardware would apparently retail for under $250, but that as part of the company's commitment to excellence, there would be a slight delay. Project Reality wouldn't hit stores until late 1995, which would be 1 year after the 3DO, and likely several months after the Sega Saturn, as well as Sony's hardware system if they decided to take the leap and enter the market with a system they were now calling the PSX. Kalinske still wasn't particularly excited about SOJ's mandate for Saturn and Mars, but at least they'd get to market quickly and provide Sega with additional opportunities to try to finish off Nintendo. And in keeping with the spirit of knocking them off the ledge, he didn't stop needling them throughout his speech. When Kalinske finished and the after-conference mingling had come to a close, it was snowing harder than before. There must have been at least 8 inches on the ground already, maybe even 10. Just then, Kalinske caught the tail end of a conversation between Main and Michael Goldstein, the president of Toys R Us, as they made their way toward the elevator. Main was still trying to cast aspersions on Kalinske's sales figures, and so Kalinske decided to intervene. "Do you really think I make this stuff up?" Kalinske asked, following the two of them into the elevator. "Why, hello, Tom," Goldstein said, happy to have both men together to settle this. "It wouldn't be the first time," Main replied, staring past Goldstein at his competitor. "And I hardly suspect it'll be the last." "How about this?" Kalinske suggested as the elevator descended. "When we leave New York, why don't you come back to Redwood Shores with me? I'll show you the data we used to come up with these numbers." "What the hell is that going to accomplish?" Main asked. "I doubt your numbers, not your ability to create a paper trail." "Gentlemen, please," Goldstein interrupted, but the sparring continued even as they reached the lobby, and it had nearly gotten physical by the time they stepped out into the snow-filled streets. "Without Nintendo, there wouldn't even be a goddamn video game industry," Peter Main declared, now inches away from his competitor's face. "What the hell do I care?" Kalinske asked, moving even closer. "Do you expect me to be grateful or something? This is business, not charity." "It was a business until you came in here with all your bullshit." "Then it must hurt even more to be losing to nothing more than bullshit." Before any punches could be thrown, Goldstein wedged himself between Main and Kalinske. "Come on, it's time to go back to your hotels." Both men wanted nothing more than for Goldstein to suddenly vanish, leaving them to try to transfer years of unrelated frustrations into each other's face. But the president of Toys R Us refused to give them this gift. He tried to flag down a cab so that he could send one of them away, but it proved very difficult because of the snow. Eventually, after several failed attempts to hail a taxi, Kalinske decided to walk uptown, and he slogged away through the thick snow. Maybe because he felt this made him the bigger man, or maybe because he was just too brittle to maintain all the anger. But more likely, it was because by walking uptown on this one-way street, he'd be able to intercept a cab that otherwise might have gone to Peter Main. Chapter 58. Roses Are Red. Throughout most of February 1994, New York City was puddled in snow and slush. It made getting around town much more difficult than usual. But the blizzard-like weather wasn't enough to keep Al Nilsen and Ellen Beth Van Buskirk apart. Since Nilsen had moved to New York for Viacom, and Van Buskirk had moved there as well to work at Sega Channel, they tried to stay in touch and get together for coffee every so often. Not only did these connections confirm to both that this friendship was of the lifelong variety, but whenever they got together, it had the strange effect of rekindling that old Sega magic. Alone, each of them was a smart, confident, and clever individual, but together they became something else. Over the years, it would always be that way, not just with the two of them, but also with Kalinske, Ryo, Toyota, Farnassier, or any of the others who had unknowingly forged this unbreakable bond. Perhaps that was what made team success such a beautiful thing. The wins and losses were inherently impermanent, but that feeling among those on the roller coaster ride would somehow sustain forever. "Remember that time we stayed up at CES all night and created the core system?" Van Buskirk mused. "And remember how annoyed those Nintendo guys looked the next morning when we came out before them with $99? "I'm still not convinced that night followed the normal rules of time," Nilsen said. "I've gone over it in my head several times since, and I've come to the conclusion that between 2 and 4 a.m., at least 8 hours actually passed." "Oh,
Van Buskirk added, happily tapping the table. And remember how strangely talented Diane was when it came to breaking and entering? How could I ever forget? How is she? Have you spoken to her? She's great. Enjoying life, enjoying work, and enjoying whatever comes in between. Actually, and please don't repeat this, she and Don are trying to get pregnant. Of course not, Nilsson said. Oh, and remember when we all had to pull that Aladdin EEPROM heist? I'm sorry to interrupt this trip down memory lane, Nilsson said, but I'm going to have to pull you over and check your license. My license to go down memory lane? Van Buskirk added. Yes, Nilsson said. I believe it's called a nostalgia permit. Oh, sure. And why is it that my license has been revoked? Because you still work for Sega. True, but not really. Sega Channel is different. Van Buskirk had expected the transition to be something like being traded in baseball, going from, say, the San Francisco Giants to the New York Mets. Definitely not the Yankees. She was forever a woman who despised the designated hitter. But moving from Sega of America to Sega Channel turned out to be more like being traded from the San Francisco baseball Giants to the New York football Giants. It was a completely different sport, and not nearly as fulfilling. She still completely believed in the vision of the company. It was a brilliant idea whose time would certainly come. But for the moment, the cable operators made it impossible in the present. By June 1994, Sega Channel would have a total of 21 companies signed up to carry the service. But the cable companies were so boringly bureaucratic and so disinterested in making the system work well or easy to use that it was going to be a struggle. Van Buskirk was up for the fight, but she missed all of her friends back in California. Well, except for Nilsson. How are Beavis and Butthead? Van Buskirk asked. Oh, you know, Nilsson replied. They're always trying to get me into trouble, but so far I've managed to resist their bad influence. Good for you. Thanks, E.B. Wait, am I still allowed to call you that? Why not? I don't have to call you E.B.V.B.K.? 1 month earlier, on January 15th, Ellen Beth Van Buskirk had married Bob Knapp, the man she had met almost a year earlier at Gate 81. Nilsson was there, and so were Ryo, Fernassier, Race, Glenn, and Schroeder, the whole gang except for Kalinske, who had suffered a tennis injury earlier that day. It was a nice little reunion, and made for an even more memorable wedding day. I told you I wasn't going to take his name, Van Buskirk reminded Nilsson. Otherwise, my name would just turn into a tongue twister. They had a laugh as they mentioned favorite tongue twisters and challenged each other to see who could repeat them faster. After racing each other through Sally's efforts to get into the seashell business, Van Buskirk remembered that she had brought something she wanted to show him. Have you seen this? She asked, pulling out a copy of the February 21st issue of Business Week. Oh, wow, Nilsson said, smiling at the issue. On the cover was a drawing full of Sega characters, Sonic, Tails, Toe Jam, the race car from Daytona, and a few others. Above them, the name Sega was in bright yellow letters, with a laudatory subtitle, The $4 billion company that stung Nintendo is making a risky push into the exploding world of high-tech entertainment. I need to run, Van Buskirk said, gathering her mittens and preparing to brave the snow. But you can borrow that if you'd like. Fantastic, Nilsson said, and bade her farewell. But before heading back to the land of Beavis and Butthead, he stayed in the coffee shop at the magazine to spend a few more minutes with Sonic and friends. The story was as wonderful as the cover indicated, but it was something at the very end of the story that caught his attention. After all the pages of gushing about Sega, Sonic, Kalinske, and Nakayama, there was an article written by Neil Gross and Robert D. Hoff after a recent interview they had conducted with Nintendo's Hiroshi Yamauchi. The article itself wasn't all that interesting, but what was interesting was that although it appeared in Business Week and would be read by millions, it seemed as if it were written exclusively for Yamauchi's son-in-law. After months of being bloodied by Sega Enterprises Ltd. in North America, Nintendo Company President Hiroshi Yamauchi is taking off the gloves. In a talk with Business Week at his Spartan headquarters in Kyoto, Yamauchi revealed a plan to recoup market share. Many details remain vague, but the stern 66-year-old patriarch of Japan's biggest game company made one thing clear. He'll make big change in the way Nintendo manages its U.S. operations, promotes its products, and develops its game.
His first priority is fixing the disaster in the U.S. market, where Nintendo's share of the 16-bit market plummeted from 60% at the end of 1992 to 37% a year later, according to Goldman Sachs and Company. With surprising candor, Yamauchi lays part of the blame on his son-in-law, Nintendo of America Inc. President Minoru Arakawa. When Sega started running comparative ads in 1990, Nintendo failed to respond. In effect, says Yamauchi, Arakawa allowed Sega to brand our games as children's toys. It was a serious mistake. Yamauchi expects Arakawa to change his style and hand more responsibility to senior American staffers. I'm giving him another chance, says the president. But even in Japan, if results don't improve, you can't stay in a job. Informed of those comments, Arakawa issued a statement promising that 1994 will be the most aggressive marketing year Nintendo of America has ever seen. What stopped Yamauchi from acting sooner is that the U.S. unit did so well under Arakawa's early stewardship. From 1987 to 1991, Nintendo's exports in the U.S. grew eightfold. Americans have snapped up over 65 million Nintendo game machines since they went on sale in 1985, but growth has slowed in the past year and profits are falling. Big words, Nilsson thought as he finished. But he had trouble imagining that Nintendo would actually do anything different. Yamauchi might be upset, but it wasn't like he was going to fire his son-in-law. Nilsson was correct. Minoru Arakawa would not be fired, but Yamauchi did end up firing a warning shot at his son-in-law. Days after the interview, Howard Lincoln received a call from Yamauchi and was informed that he was Nintendo of America's new chairman, making him co-manager of NOA with Arakawa. It was just a title, and Lincoln had always been steering the ship right there with Arakawa, but it meant that for the first time in years, Nintendo was willing to change. And that was significant. A couple of months later, Perrin Kaplan was in San Francisco to visit Silicon Graphics and discuss ways to position Project Reality. She was joined there by Don Variu, a former news director. He had won the 1988 Edward R. Murrow Award for the best local news operation in the country, who had transitioned into public relations and been working with NOA since 1991. He was a lover of telling stories, a man who knew how to combine big ideas with small anecdotes, and as a result of this passion and talent, he had earned Nintendo's trust and was often involved in the company's big-picture messaging. He was also usually the one who worked with Peter Main and Howard Lincoln to craft their speeches for press conferences, analyst meetings, and the CES shows. I'm sure the parent already has at least a million golden ideas, Variu explained to the guys at SGI. But I think something we should keep in the back of our minds throughout is the cautionary tale of 3DO. The 32-bit 3DO console had only been out for a few months, but it had failed so badly that it already felt like a thing of the past. A large part of the failure was the system's ridiculous price tag, $699. But another part was that it had been marketed so heavily as the technological answer to everything that nobody thought of it when it came to a specific anything. It was a video game system, a movie player, and a CD-ROM device, but nobody thought of it as the video game system, the movie player, or the CD-ROM device. Even more important than taking it as a lesson in the value of specificity, Nintendo interpreted the failure of the 3DO as proof that consumers need more than just technology. For years, Sega had been goading Nintendo into entering a technological arms race, and although they had thus far resisted, there was always that temptation to consider the what-ifs. But after 3DO, Nintendo felt even more confident in their longer-term, higher-quality strategy, particularly when it came to demonstrating patience with Project Reality. As Kaplan and Variu started discussing the broad strokes of the messaging behind Nintendo's new console, a secretary from SGI interrupted them with an urgent message. Howard needs to speak with you immediately, she advised Kaplan, who went outside to take the call. Minutes later, she returned, looking half astonished, half petrified. You're not going to believe what Howard wants to do. Probably not, Variu replied. But now I'm very curious to find out. How do you feel about poetry? Kaplan asked, still with that peculiar look on her face. Particularly, poems that rhyme. Uh-oh. Variu replied, now sporting the same expression as Kaplan. Earlier that morning, Howard Lincoln had come across a quote from Tom Kalinske in which he claimed to be amazed that Nintendo would so irresponsibly drag retailers and the entire video game industry through the mud in their efforts to slow down our momentum. Lincoln was stunned by the quote. It represented exactly how we felt, except about Sega. They were the ones who had caused this whole mess and threatened to ruin the industry with their blatant disregard for integrity. Not only was Kalinske's quote patently ridiculous, but the timing of it was almost as offensive. About 6 weeks earlier, Sega, Nintendo, and the industry's other major players had come to an agreement to set up a national ratings board, which would later become the Entertainment Software Ratings Board, ESRB. Dr. Arthur Pober would head the effort and work to get the operation up and running by the end of the year. To supervise the ratings board and also usher the industry into maturity, Kalinske had played a vital role in creating the Interactive Digital Software Association, IDSA. Accomplishing both of these things in such a short period of time was no small task, but it had the desired effect of impressing Senator Lieberman and the other representatives, so following the second round of hearings in March, the politicians decided to give the video game industry the autonomy to regulate itself. There was no doubt that Kalinske deserved a significant amount of credit for rallying the industry, but so did Lincoln. Pulling this off required unity, compromise, and string-pulling on the part of both leaders, but they had gotten it done and managed to save their respective companies from the clutches of Congress. Lincoln harbored no illusions that they were now friends, nor did he believe that Sega and Nintendo would ever blissfully hold hands and waltz into the next generation of video games, but come on! For Kalinske to say what he'd said, and to say it so soon? Give me a break. Lincoln was mad, and wanted a way to fire back at Kalinske. In the past, that outlet had often been litigation, but here that made no sense. The most efficient and effective response would be to give an interview or issue some kind of press release. But both of these methods felt too tame, too expected, and too unmemorable. Lincoln would say something, and then Kalinske would say something back, and the word count between the two would pile up faster than dead Montagues and Capulets. What Lincoln needed was a way to end the conversation and make sure Nintendo had the final word, and ideally, have some fun in the process. Over the past couple of years, and particularly the past couple of months, Nintendo had stopped remembering to have fun. That likely had a lot to do with Sega taking a bite out of Nintendo's market share, but it was time to remember what Nintendo was all about. When asked what she did for a living, Perrin Kaplan used to say, "I sell joy," and she'd been 100% correct. Nintendo was about wandering through the Mushroom Kingdom and saving the princess. That was what they did for a living, and it was time to bring back the fun. Yamauchi had appointed Lincoln as chairman to start making changes, and there was no better way to demonstrate this new era at Nintendo than by publicly doing something fun. Kaplan loved this attitude and was with Lincoln every step of the way, except when it came time to demonstrate the fun. "A poem?" Varyu confirmed. "Actually," she revised, "a Roses Are Red poem." "That's terrible, isn't it?" "Absolutely." "Good, because that's what I told him." "And what did he say?" "He said I was right." Varyu sighed with relief. What an embarrassment that would have been. After a relieved chuckle, he and Kaplan got back to discussing Project Reality. Things were going well until an hour later, when the secretary returned with news that Howard Lincoln was on the line again. This time Varyu went into the hallway with her and stated his case for why this was a terrible idea. Although Lincoln was angry with Kalinske and upset by their reaction, he could see the reason in their logic and thanked both of them for their advice. Once again, they felt glad to get back to their discussions about how to position Nintendo's new 64-bit system. Sophisticated, but accessible. A high-powered machine, but one that didn't look intimidating. Everyone was on the same page, and they appeared to be getting somewhere until, for the third time, Howard Lincoln called to discuss poetry. "It's still not a good idea," Kaplan responded in faux exasperation. "And since we last spoke, I think I've come up with at least 10 more reasons why." "Howard, buddy," Varyu added, "I admire the effort, but you just can't do it." "Well, actually," Lincoln replied, sounding as calm and calculating as he always did, "I can. I'm the chairman, and I'm doing it." The following day, Nintendo issued a press release with a poem that the new chairman had written. "Dear Tom, roses are red, violets are blue, so you had a bad day. Boo-hoo-hoo-hoo. All my best, Howard."
Chapter 59. Blast from the Past.
"Now tell me," Olufsen said from his office in New York, as he interviewed candidates for the president's job at Sony Computer Entertainment of America, SCEA. "What have you been up to since departing Sega?" The candidate chuckled. "How much time do you have?" Olufsen liked this guy already, and his answers further convinced Olufsen that he was the right man to run SCEA, which had been formed in May 1994 as the formal division within Sony to launch its new video game console, PSX. Much like he did with Sony ImageSoft and Psygnosis, Olufsen would oversee this new division, but whoever became president would be given the space to operate as he or she saw fit. Although the Sony name carried a lot of weight, there was skepticism about this venture from retailers, from distributors, and most of all, from consumers. Whoever became responsible for launching the PSX would need to be an intuitive thinker, an inspiring leader, and a smooth talker. And, as crass as it may sound, would need to have balls of steel. "But on a serious note," Olufsen continued, "where has the world taken you?" The candidate, Steve Race, smirked. He loved to tell a good story. "Let's see. After Sega, I did a few turnaround assignments for some venture capital firms that I've kept in touch with over the years. Nothing wild, nothing lasting more than a couple of months until I got a call from Philips. They wanted me to come in and evaluate this product called DBI. Have you ever seen this thing? I'd sprinkle in a few details about the piece of shit, but it's a waste of goddamn brain space if you ask me. Anyway, I came to the conclusion, very quickly, that this was a non-competitive product and they ought to shut it down. They became we, ultimately me, and I was given the exciting task of dismantling this needlessly elaborate house of cards. Is that something you take pleasure in?" Ray shrugged. "I'm good at it, I guess. I seem to do well with putting things together, or with taking things apart." "Beginnings and endings," Olufsen said. "Well, that pretty much runs the spectrum, then. Do you not possess any areas of weakness?" "Oh, I've got plenty of those," Race said with a grin. "Would you like to share?" "Nah," Race replied. "If you bring me in, you'll find out soon enough." The interview progressed very nicely from there. Olufsen appreciated Race's run-through-a-wall mentality and his ability to convince others to follow him through. This would be particularly valuable given that Sony would be selling a product nobody had ever seen, heard of, or thought about before. Race, too, was taken with Olufsen, whom he quickly nicknamed the Nordic Knucklehead. As Race heard more about the budgets that would be involved and Sony's commitment to aggressive marketing, he began to covet the chance to once again shake up the video game industry with his heat-seeking competitive strategies and snarky brand of shenanigans. But as at Sega, there was a lingering concern. "To be perfectly honest," Race explained, "I'm very reluctant to go and work for a Japanese company. That kind of conservative micromanaging is not really for me, so can you tell me a little about what that dynamic would look like?"
"This is an excellent question," Olufsen replied, "and I believe you would be pleased with the answer. Essentially, Sony Corporate does not fully believe in what we are doing. They have agreed to pay a few bills and opened a couple of connections, but it seems to me like they might be very happy if we just went ahead and failed spectacularly. This sounds like embellishment, perhaps, but there is a hard edge of truth to it. For example, they would prefer we don't use the Sony name on the product, and they have already prohibited its usage on the packing."
Sounds like a serious bummer."
"It is," Olufsen agreed. "But with this imposed distance comes a certain level of freedom, one which I believe would suit you quite well."
This was mostly truth, but it was also what Olufsen knew Race needed to hear. He also knew that given Race's reputation for either flaming out or getting bored easily, he likely wouldn't be at the company long enough for this to become a major issue. At this specific time, Race was the right man for the job, and so Olufsen offered to protect him from the Japanese if this man, who had had a finger in Atari, Nintendo, and Sega, was willing to slap on an eye patch and come sail Sony's pirate ship into the unknown.
"One more question," Olufsen said, "which I had failed to ask earlier. Sega, do you have any ill will toward them?"
"No," Race replied. "The opposite, actually. I think rather highly of Kalinske and what he's got going on over there.
And it will be no problem for you to compete with former colleagues?
Not at all, Race said, shaking his head in a way that made it appear weightless. As the saying goes, the devil you know is more fun to do battle with than the devil you don't.
Olufsen wasn't quite sure the saying went this way, but he couldn't argue with the logic of SCEA's soon-to-be president, and he wouldn't dare do anything to dampen that wonderful fighting spirit.
While Olufsen was at work reeling in a blast from the past, Kalinske took the opportunity to welcome one of his own, Mike Fisher, the American at SOJ who had been such a great, subtle peacemaker over the years. Fisher had been on the fence about leaving Sega of Japan, but after his father's recent heart attack and the quintuple bypass that followed, it felt like the right time to move back to the United States. And so, in the spring of 1994, Fisher had left SOJ to join SOA and help Kalinske oversee SOE. With Sega's rapid ascension in Europe, Fisher's move appeared to have come at the perfect time. But as excited as Kalinske was to have a trusted colleague building European relations, he worried about what this meant for his Japanese relations. Fisher had always alerted him to things on SOJ's radar, but now he would be flying blind.
"Let me ask you a question," Kalinske began, giving Fisher a tour of Sega's headquarters at Redwood Shores. "Are you at all opposed to my cloning you? That way you can work both here and in Japan?"
"Not at all," Fisher said with a smile. "As long as I, or rather my clone and I, are getting paid double."
"Sure," Kalinske replied. "I'll just have to check with HR about that."
Although Fisher was being treated to the same wit as usual, he sensed something askew in Kalinske's tone.
"Tom, is everything okay?"
99 times out of 100, Kalinske answered that question with an optimistic non-response. But there was something about Fisher that always relaxed his demeanor.
"I don't know," Kalinske said,
pausing to let a group of smiling employees from product development pass by.
"These are just weird times, I suppose."
"What kind of weird?"
Kalinske didn't quite know how to put it into words, but it was a very specific feeling.
"It's hard to say," he described, scouring his mind for the best example of this wordless thing. "But it's happening more and more lately."
"Okay, I realize that sounds ominous, so let me just give you an example. Earlier today, I was looking at the most recent software numbers."
"Were they good?"
"No," Kalinske replied.
"They were fantastic."
Fantastic was an understatement.
Of the top 10 video games sold in March 1994, 8 of them were for the Genesis, and 4 of them were published directly by Sega. 1, NBA Jam, Genesis. 2, NBA Jam, SNES. 3, Sonic 3, Genesis. 4, Mortal Kombat, Genesis. 5, Aladdin, Genesis. 6, Ken Griffey Jr. Baseball, SNES. 7, NHL 94, Genesis. 8, NBA Showdown 94, Genesis. 9, World Series Baseball, Genesis. 10, Sonic Spinball, Genesis.
"That's terrific, Tom," Fisher declared. "You should be proud."
"We should be proud," Kalinske corrected. "But that's the point I'm trying to make. When I look at those figures, I should be overjoyed. And part of me is, believe me. But another part can't help but fast forward to a couple of years from now and wonder if Sega will even have one game in the top 10. Have you seen the Saturn?"
"I'm sure the developers are still getting used to the environment," Fisher explained.
"Besides, concerns like that are normal. We all occasionally suffer from fear of success. It's human."
"That's what I thought at first," Kalinske replied. "But what if it's not actually fear of success, and actually fear of something lurking beneath that success? Almost like it's a perfect day at the beach, the sun is shining and the water is warm, but right there beneath the surface, there's a very hungry shark."
"Interesting," Fisher said, bobbing his head side to side. "Well, if that were the case, and I don't think it is, then you have two choices. Enjoy it while it lasts, or learn how to outswim the shark."
"What if it's already too late?" Kalinske wanted to ask.
He looked around the office, taking great pride in having built such a powerful team. 8 out of 10 titles in the top 10. Outstanding.
But what if it really was already too late?
Instead of asking this, however, Kalinske showed Fisher to his new office and officially welcomed him to Sega of America.
Huh?
Minoru Arakawa quietly murmured when his key card did not work. He tried it once more, but again was denied. And it slowly dawned on Arakawa that he had not been granted access to the third-floor office space that Tony Harmon had taken to calling the treehouse.
Tony!